Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Before it is too late, I set out the events exactly as I recall them. I seem to recall them very well, and they were not of a kind easily forgotten. But amnesia is, I know, more likely to play a part in my tale than exaggeration. As a matter of policy, I am determined to damp down, to play down, to pipe down. I am a man of the 20th century, as much as anyone else. Of course, when it comes to carrying conviction, I make a bad start by being an author. After all, he is an author, I remember my grandmother saying when I anxiously questioned her about a particularly improbable tale Maurice Hewlett had told at her tea party that afternoon. I dare say it is precisely because I have sometimes made small sums of money with my pen that I have not related before now this story that is true. And really, with my pen, with this very pen, in fact. And I was using the same pen when, a year or two after the war, the real war, the first one, I took up my abode at the top of a house in Brandenburg Square. Fountain pens could then be had that were designed positively to last at least one lifetime.
They don't make them like they used to. That goes for fountain pens, and that also goes for authors. After a quick detour into Haunted Parrot Cove, we are back to covering Mr. Robert Aichman.
We tried to stay away, but we couldn't. We needed more. So this week we're jumping into the Aichman classic, Meeting Mr. Miller.
By the way, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. You are joining us here at Strange Studies of Strange Stories. Welcome.
Our reader, once again, is Mr. Greg Johnson. He's a wonderful actor and maker of things. Please click on over to his Etsy store and pick something up.
This story was originally published in the 1975 collection, Cold Hand and Mine.
Aichman is on my list of things to scrounge for when I'm hitting the bookstores, and I was so excited a couple of weeks ago when I was able to find Cold Hand and Mine at Half Price Books. Mm-hmm. It's the late 70s Scribner's U.S. edition, and I got it for $5.
Yeah!
This copy of Cold Hand and Mine from the 70s has a jacket illustration by the legendary Edward Gorey. It's a giant hand lying on the ground outside of a lonely English estate. I mean, really a giant hand. Maybe Gorey thought the intended audience of this book was Godzilla. This collection also has the subtitle Strange Stories. Aichman's work previously had been branded as ghost stories or macabre stories. It wasn't until the collection Sub Rosa from 68 and then this one that he began using the descriptor Strange Stories, which is a much better choice of words for these, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Let's just jump right into it.
As you heard at the top, we have a real weird tale intro. The author explains that he's about to tell you something. Something hard to believe, but that he swears is true.
He tells us he's a writer, which might make us think he's also a liar. That opening we heard name checks the British historical novelist Maurice Hewlett, someone the narrator's grandmother knew personally. But he assures us he's much more likely to leave things out than exaggerate anything.
So it begins with our protagonist, Roy, living in a three-bedroom attic flat in London for cheap, which is, even at this time, finding a cheap place in London was difficult.
Oh, yeah.
And I also discovered that in the 1970s in England, a cupboard was also referred to as a glory hole.
I hope so, because he did use that term, and I thought, I wonder if anybody ever pointed to that more antiquated meaning as an excuse, you know? Yes, I was arrested at a glory hole, but I swear to you, I thought I was going there to get some flour. I didn't know that was going to come out.
Now, Roy says that his father was killed in the war, and his mother raised him on her own. We know from the top that he's a writer, and his paying gig is as an editor for pornographic stories. Other people's porn stories, not his own.
That was a little surprising. We don't often get a profession like that on this show.
No, we don't. He is 18 when the story is taking place, and the guy that gave him the work was a friend of his father's from the war, Mr. Valentine. Since he wasn't sure how to break into writing, he figured this is a start.
I think Aichman knew that someday we'd be covering his stuff for Valentine's Day, so the name of that character was a little nod to Strange Studies of Strange Stories. It's a setup that I'd expect more from a Michael Shea story, actually.
Yeah.
You know, wannabe writer editing porn in the upper rooms of a dodgy building.
Uh-huh.
He changes the name of the house to protect its reputation and avoid lawsuits, but he clarifies, I believe mine to be a narrative of a haunted man rather than a haunted house.
When he took possession of the attic bedroom, there were two tenants below him. The second floor was an office for a political weekly magazine called Freedom, and the basement had a young man and woman of mildly intellectual aspect. They had kids as well. The man is called Gilbert. He worked all day, was rarely around. And his wife, Maureen, the kids are at school all day, so she spends a lot of time hanging around.
It's four kids.
Yeah.
So she does have to work part-time as well just to support that big brood. But there are a few hours every day in the afternoon before she has to pick them up when she's in the house alone.
Now, Marie would often come by to chat during the day. Sometimes that would annoy him, well, at first, but he grew to like the attention of this pretty older woman. Mm-hmm. And he says one time he went down to have a meal with the whole family, but Gilbert just sat there, tired, and the kids were old enough to stay up and ask questions and fall about. I think I know exactly what he's saying. That seems to be about between 8 and 11 right there, that age.
Yeah.
And so they never tried that again. He never went over and had a meal with them. The ground floor and the first floors of the building are an unused outlet. At this point, the author says, he's kissing Maureen's hair.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess they're more than friends?
Right. It was a surprise. Yeah, it's a surprise when you're reading it, right? At first, it just seems like she's popping up to have some coffee. And then he's like, oh, I probably was kissing her hair while I said that.
Oh, what?
So something's developed, I guess.
Kissing her
the
hair.
The descriptions of this affair with Maureen are all very in line with how an 18-year-old might reveal details of something about this.
Sure.
Begrudging, confusing, never giving you the whole story. He himself is not really sure how he feels about anything. Maureen had talked to the window cleaners in the building about those floors between his room and the Freedom offices. There's like two floors there. From them, she got, there's nothing inside but emptiness. That's a theme that goes throughout this story, because even when those floors become occupied, we'll find they're still empty in a way.
One night, Roy notices that the staff of Freedom is staying late, and they're moving stuff out of the building. The next day, he is awakened by the builders working, making noise, and he finds it hard to work on his work while this is going on, so he moves back in with his mom while they fix up the floors.
Presumably for a new tenant. He also says in this passage that the builders are in for an endless 3 weeks to work on the place, although nowadays it would be 6 or 9. More references to the disintegration of work ethic, that now it would take much longer because people just don't work as hard.
Now, when Roy returns, Maureen tells him that the ground first and second floor have all been occupied by an accounting firm called Stalabrass, Hoskins, and Cramp. Chartered accountants.
Sounds suspiciously like the book title Lichen, Moss, and Rack.
When the business moves in, finally, there's a lot of short-haired, short-skirted young women working in the new office, and guys in white shirts. A lot more people are working here than were at Freedom.
Although Freedom was a suspicious operation as well, it was a small circulation newspaper that couldn't have made much money, yet employed a pretty big group of foreigners, of non-English people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is the newspaper what they were really doing down there?
Right.
It's that kind of confusion and suspicion one has about businesses. That psychic cannot be making enough money to support that real estate.
Right.
What's really going on in there?
Yeah.
And the landlords of this place are totally disengaged with the management of the building. So the implication is that this is probably a place where businesses that are somewhat shady can move in and conduct business.
So that afternoon, he gets a knock from Maureen. She asks if he's seen Mr. Miller, the guy in charge. And she says that he looks like Cordoba the Sex Vampire, which was a silent film from the time, but not a real silent film, because I tried to find it and there was no record of a Cordoba the Sex Vampire movie.
It gave me a listing of a bunch of sex vampires in Spain, which I followed up on, but it didn't help me with notes. I think that's a thinly veiled reference to Nosferatu, which came out in 1922, which is funny that that's a fake name for Nosferatu, Nosferatu being a fake name for Dracula that they wound up getting sued about. Mm-hmm. But there's some mention of the prime minister in a later conversation, who was the prime minister until 1922. So I think that puts this story pretty solidly in that year, where it's the first couple of years of the 20s.
Roy feels a bit wary of Mr. Miller and tries to just stay away from everyone in this new business. And he's annoyed with all of them because they're always talking and giggling and making it hard for him to get his work done. But he can't make out a single word that they're saying. And what he does here just seems to be vapid or commonplace. It's all very empty. And something about it all frightens Roy, but he can't put his finger on why.
Everything about this business and the people that work there is empty. They're not even sure if the names on the accounting business are real people.
Right.
So the whole thing's a facade.
Yeah.
He complains about these people in the 20s that they'll just let the phone ring and ring without grabbing it up. And in the early 20s, a business having a bunch of phones would be a new thing.
Sure.
Similarly, you know, I still can't believe how many people just let their cell phones blow up in public or will sit there watching a video with the sound up.
Oh, man,
totally careless. of whether other people have to hear it or not. Mm-hmm. And it's this erosion of basic respect for others. And he says, you know, when they do pick up the phone, what he hears is always of unbelievable commonplaces or banality, not business in any sense. Mm-hmm. Empty talk. From a young person's perspective, there's a horror to that. It's the horror of becoming boring.
Oh, sure.
You know, this like your greatest fear.
He also notes that there was a big turnaround with these young women working at this new place. The girls never seemed to last more than a few days before being replaced by new girls.
Not so with the men working there, who are older than the girls and seem to stay the same.
And the vibe from these older men, every time he would walk by or down the halls, they would just stare at him.
It's like this erosion of basic social skills. They can't even be polite.
Now, Roy also notes that he's never seen any clients coming in to this accounting firm. Mm. And after a month there, Roy actually finally meets Mr. Miller. Around 5 o'clock, Miller just knocks on his door to his apartment and introduces himself. He invites Roy to come down and have a drink. And he also says, strangely, you can bring anyone you like. Weird that he's suggesting I bring anybody I like because I live here by myself. He goes in. Miller seems disappointed that he didn't bring anybody with him, offers him a sherry. Roy notices that Miller never really looks at him, even when they're talking, like he just is off kind of staring in the distance. Mm-hmm. They make small talk about the weather and sports, where Roy is from, what paper he reads. Roy gets the feeling that Miller is distracted or thinking about something other than this conversation, and there's a lot of awkward pauses. He says that Miller seems to be around 40. He's slender, has dark hair, kind of handsome.
That's what most of the sex vampires in Cordoba look like.
Exactly.
So that's right in line with it. Yeah.
Miller says he just wants to let Roy know that they're very busy right now and they're going to be working into the night, just so you don't think there's any burglars about. People are supposed to be in the office, even though it's going to be really late, which, of course, is terrible news to hear to somebody that lives under a place. Like, oh, God. He also says that he lives a long way away and can't go home every night, so he'll have to be around the office and even sleep there from time to time. With that, Roy makes his excuses and leaves.
Yeah, horrible news, like you said. Really, that's the purpose of the visit. He's like, look, I don't want to disturb that family in the basement, so at night when I'm working and making noise, I'm going to do it on the floor right below you. The chief characteristic of Mr. Miller, besides emptiness and banality, is distraction. Mm. His eyes are always somewhere else. It always seems that he's paying attention to something far off.
Roy notes that most folks leave the office at a regular time, but Miller seems to be potting around every night. He would hear Miller on the phone talking to himself. Roy even tried to eavesdrop, but Miller never said anything that was interesting. So after some time passes, Miller begins to have visitors. Kind of shady men hanging around. Shady women as well, maybe prostitutes.
There was a description of the neighborhood that said there were streets in the immediate area where it was far easier to pick up a woman and do what you liked to her than to pick up a taxi. And that was some very Shea-esque seediness injected into the proceedings.
Mm-hmm. Having these people hanging around the building made Roy not want to invite any of his friends over or any of his lady friends. None of these people hanging around also never talked to Roy. They would stop talking when he passed by and say nothing to him. Even Mr. Miller wouldn't say anything, wouldn't even look at Roy when he would walk by. Roy says that these men look like criminals and that very rarely would men or women be seen together. They were often like a group of women or a group of men.
Yeah.
Some sort of self-segregation was going on with them.
Different businesses happening.
Now, Roy wonders if maybe some of these people aren't clients and Miller does accounting for criminals. He considered moving out, but his 3-bedroom was cheap and sweet in London, and he would be hard-pressed to find anything better by far.
As he's talking about being frozen in this place, there's a passage that really resonated. It says, I was antagonized by almost everything to do with Mr. Miller, yet I realized that he was an experience or ordeal I might be unwise to avoid. Could not live forever as a child, free and light as air. As we acquire weight in the world, we lose it within ourselves. Maturity is always in part a matter of emptying and contracting.
Some time passes and Maureen knocks on the door one evening. She asks how he's getting on. And it's sort of strange because he hasn't talked to her in months since these new people have been in. And she looks normal. She's a bit messy, as if she's had to deal with the kids and housework. And he just goes in for a kiss and then leads Maureen in. And he takes her clothes off and then his own. And then they go to his bed and they have sex. Maybe for the first time. I'm not sure if this is the first time. It seemed like the way that it was being described that it was the first time they were having sex.
So romantic.
She leaves and he wants to know when he's going to see her again. And she goes, I can't make any promises. I got a family to deal with. How did you feel about all this? A married woman and she's cheating on her husband who's working really hard.
I mean, we assume, who knows, he could have something on the side as well. But it made me feel really terrible. Affairs always, I will purposely not watch something or read something if there's an affair in it.
Huh.
There was some television show that everybody liked called The Affair. I said, no way. All I do is sit around and feel bad for the people who are getting cheated on. That's it. Just like, that's it. And so that happened in this story where, especially near the end, when he actually sits down and has a conversation with the husband, I was like, oh man, how can you sit there and talk to somebody knowing you're doing that to them?
Maybe I was making excuses up for them in the story, but I wondered if, I almost got the impression during that conversation that he knew Maureen was having sex with him, with Roy, and he doesn't really care.
To be clear, that's not a judgment I'm making based on the sanctity of marriage.
Oh, no.
Like, for me, it's the dishonesty that bothers me.
Yes.
But if you're all on the level, if this is like
an open relationship,
that might actually be a great arrangement.
Now, Miller seems to be ramping up. Roy notes that Miller is drinking a lot more and he never sees him during the day anymore. Maybe he's sleeping during the day and partying all night.
Well, the whole place smells like booze, which I know what that's like when walk into a building and you're like, whoa.
The brewery in here?
Fumes.
Sometimes Roy would come home and see Miller just hanging out on the stairs by himself. When I returned home, I would sometimes find him not wandering about, but sprawling or huddled up on the staircase, very white and disheveled, breathing hard, and once or twice with the pupils of his eyes unnaturally turned upwards. The stairs would smell of drink and sometimes the whole house, though I do not think I ever actually saw Mr. Miller with a glass in his hand or a bottle. That thought makes him wonder if he's just going to come in one day and Miller's going to be dead on the stairs. Sometimes the police show up to this place, and on a few occasions, Roy has had women coming up and knocking on his door, crying and wanting to come into his place, and he would always escort them out of the building past scary dudes that would say nothing to him or the woman when he left. Also, when he came back, they wouldn't say anything. And sometimes he'd walk past Miller, who, again, wouldn't say anything. So one time, a different type of woman showed up on his door looking for help. She said she met Miller at Wimbledon and that she should have known better. Though she knew she had been a fool, she had no idea it would be like this. I had no idea it could be, she said, her eyes boring into me. Roy walks her down to the street and she immediately feels better and apologizes for bothering Roy. Once she's out of that place and away from Miller, all of the weight just goes away from her. More and different guys are hanging out in the building. One guy in particular really caught Roy's notice. He's red-faced, stocky man with a green suit and a green pork pie hat. And this guy seems to have his own key and would go in, knock stuff around. He would hear him stomping around and then leave, relocking the door as he left. Again, bizarre, and he doesn't know what this dude's doing in there besides making a big racket. So one time, this guy just pushes past Roy, shoving him to the wall and bruising his elbow. So this dude is a bruiser of some kind.
And it's really this guy showing up so frequently that's going to push Roy to leave the building.
Yeah. And by this time, Roy is spending weekends with his mother to stay away from this place. But one weekend, his mom is away and he's having to stay in his own flat. This Saturday night was unusual because nobody's around at all. And in the middle of the night, Roy is awakened by a noise from the floor below him. And it's very late and the noise sounds different than before, like maybe a burglar. And he decides he's going to investigate, armed with his fire poker.
Without turning on the light, I opened the outer door. I looked down my pitch dark flight of stairs. When a light was on further down, I could from this point always see the glow. Now, there was no light. I became aware that a smell was wafting up. It was quite faint, at least where I was, but nonetheless, extremely pungent and penetrating. I must admit that the expression, a graveyard smell, leapt into my mind at the first whiff of it. Even a faint whiff was quite enough to make me feel sick in a moment, but I managed to hang on, even to listen with all the intentness I could muster. There could be no doubt about the reality of the sounds beneath me, but every doubt about what caused them. Something, or someone, was shuffling and rubbing about in the almost total darkness. I found it impossible to decide on which landing or on which part of the staircase. In a flight of rather absurd logic, the thought of a blind person came to me. But truly, the sounds hardly seemed human at all. More like a heavy sack, wearily dragging about on its own volition. not able to manage very well, and perhaps anxious not to disturb the wrong person. As well as feeling sick, really sick, as if about to be sick, I was trembling so much that no difficult further decision was needed. Investigation was just physically impossible.
So after that, he goes back to his apartment, locks the door, and he's done.
Why did you choose that selection to be read?
I thought that that was a really creepy and almost supernatural bit. Mm. And what is it? Why is it there? Why is it with Miller? What's Miller up to? Is he doing some warlock stuff? Did he summon up a demon? Is there some undead thing that he brought from the grave? I don't know. The next day, he hears the footsteps of a guy in the green suit. But this time, they're coming up to his apartment. And the guy doesn't knock. He just stands in front of the door. And eventually he bangs on the door and Roy answers. The guy's like, well, why didn't you open the door? Didn't you hear me? And Roy's like, yeah, I heard you, but I didn't know what you were doing. And then they look at each other. And the guy asks Roy if he's seen anyone around yesterday or today. And Roy says, truthfully, I haven't seen anybody. Trying to be evasive. But the guy knows that he's experienced something. And Roy just says, I don't know what it was. And the guy just says, so they've arrived.
Roy asks, who do you mean by they? I'm not telling you that, my boy, the guy responds.
You'll never see me again for dust. There's an end to all things. Thanks for the tip-off. And the guy leaves.
This guy has an educated voice. It's almost like he's a detective. There's an end to all things. Again, it seems like a change is about to happen downstairs. Uh-huh. And Roy's not sure he wants to be there for it.
Roy goes down to talk to Maureen, but her husband answers and tells him that Maureen has had a breakdown and she's in the hospital. He tells her husband that it's living in this house. Roy says, I'm moving out. You should move out as well. Maureen's husband invites him in for some coffee and Roy accepts.
This is what I was referencing. I cannot fathom how somebody could sit there and have that conversation. But as you say, maybe it's just casual because they both know what's up.
If not, then yeah, it's a terrible thing to do. Roy says that the people upstairs don't run a normal business, and Gilbert, that's Maureen's husband, agrees. Gilbert strangely asks if Roy is clairvoyant. Roy says no, but then Gilbert says this. It just struck me for one moment that you might have seen into the future. All these people slavishly doing nothing. It'll be exactly like that one day, you know, if we go on as we are. For a moment, it all sounded to me like a vision of 40 years on, if as much.
And 40 years from this time of the story would be the 60s, which is perhaps when Aikman wrote this. So he's talking about his own time, his own era.
Right. Now, Roy goes on to tell him about the strange thing in the night and the guy in the green suit in the morning. Gilbert puts it rather plainly, so we got undead in here too? It puts Roy back a bit, and he realizes, yeah, I guess I was implying that, but I never really admitted it to myself that I thought something unnatural was happening. Maybe this place is haunted by the victims of Mr. Miller and his associates.
It says Mr. Miller might always be on the move, always running away, and going through the hoops in the attempt to forget, through all the hoops he can find.
And Gilbert says he thinks that Miller is up to no good, but they just can't move, at least for now. So they'll just have to put up with the ghosts.
It's that rent control thing, you know? If you'd seen what Maureen and I have seen, you'd think twice about moving out. This is a good deal. Mm-hmm. Quote, there's always something that's bloody about living among the toiling masses.
Over the next few weeks, Roy is trying to move out, but he can't find any place else to live. Business seems to carry on downstairs in the office. He hears Miller beating it up with three noisy girls until dawn and decides that he can't face the weekend at the place, and he goes to stay with his mother.
He makes an honest effort to look for another place to live for about a week. He says it doesn't sound like very long, but it's surprising how many small, dark cavities a week can unearth.
Roy comes back on Monday morning to find the place quiet. The front door is locked. And he needs to use his key to get inside, something he never has to do with a busy office. Roy checks inside. All the doors of the offices are all locked too, and nobody's there.
The change has come.
Maureen is up on the steps as if waiting for Roy to arrive, and she says, all is silent as a tomb. But Roy he runs up to her, and he hugs and kisses her. She says that she was unwell, and then suddenly not. She's back home now. She bought some new clothes, and she feels pretty happy.
She's like a victim under a vampiric influence. Now that the vamp is gone, she's good.
He has Maureen come upstairs, but they stop on Miller's floor, and for the hell of it, Roy tries Miller's door, and it opens, and he peeks inside.
I tried to push Maureen out, but I failed. Mr. Miller was hanging there, in the outer office for all to see, and from a large hook meant for hanging overcoats on a wall, which he, or someone, must have spent much time screwing into the plaster of the ceiling. Or rather, I imagine, through the ceiling into one of the wooden joists of my floor above. The most curious thing was that though there was no detectable movement of air in the room, the body swung back and forth, quite perceptibly, as if it had been made out of papier-mâché or some other featherweight expendable. Even the clothes looked papery and insubstantial. Was it the real Mr. Miller at all who dangled there? It was remarkably hard to be sure. A curious thing of another kind was that though, for a long time, I had been scared out of my wits by events in the house, and Maureen perhaps literally so, yet from quite soon after that climactic Sunday, I began to feel reasonably happy there almost all the time. Indeed, very happy indeed, when I thought about Maureen, or covered her sweet hair with kisses, and entirely forgot the idea of moving, or as entirely as life ever permits one, to forget anything.
And that's the end of it. But so Miller's so empty that he's swinging like he's made of papier-mâché.
Yeah.
Everything about him is insubstantial. So continuing that thing on, you know, I don't really know what happened here. Did the pork pie hat guy hang him?
Maybe. But that guy said that you're never going to see me again.
Yeah.
And then a few weeks passed by. Maybe he hung himself. Maybe he just got in trouble. Or maybe he was tired of his life and it was a legitimate suicide where he got up to so much no good that he just couldn't bear it anymore and offed himself.
And Roy tries to explain why he's hanging from this hook, as, you know, must have been screwed into one of the joists up above, because there's no way this guy's light enough that just a hook and some plaster would support him.
Right.
But maybe he is.
Yeah.
I mean, the title is kind of irony because he doesn't really meet Mr. Miller.
No.
He doesn't really get to know him.
No.
Meeting him is just seeing him, and there's all this emptiness in both the building itself and in this person.
Yeah.
There's an epigraph at the beginning of this collection that Aikman included that says, "In the end, it is the mystery that lasts and not the explanation." That's by Sacheverell Sitwell from For Want of the Golden City. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that author's name correctly, but Clearly this is Aikman's ethos.
Yeah.
In the end, it's the mystery that lasts and not the explanation. We're not going to get an explanation for this.
No.
This would have been a good Marches for Dracula's. It's got vampire references in it. And the vampire, as we've discussed before, is sort of this empty vessel that's trying to take the vitality from others.
We definitely get that from Mr. Miller, that there is some sort of predatory behavior that's going on with him, as we see with all these. Is it supernatural, though? Or is it just he's a shady bad guy? Not sure.
No, I don't know. And, you know, I don't really need the explanation. I get why he put that epigraph in there, because if you just told me about this, I would guess that it would be an unsatisfying story. Well, if you don't find out what happens, then it's just words on a page. Like, who cares? Kind of the way people talk about art films or something
sure.
like that.
Right.
But it was a really good read.
It's a really good read.
Even though I don't really know what happened. And maybe there's something obvious I'm missing, which frequently happens on the show, and somebody will say, oh, duh, you know, ABC, but I didn't see it. I was tracking with it for a while in that it was about fear of business and fear of losing your individuality and authenticity.
Which is also larger society taking you away. You know, like you become a part of the society and doing so you lose the self. You know, as you were saying earlier, to become part of a group, you're going to have to compromise, and that compromise, that means you becoming something that's not you. Whatever that means, because for me, I am part of the society. So those compromises are part of who I am, I guess.
Yeah.
Who would I be if I lived out in the middle of the woods and didn't interact with people and went all the Stains out on the moors?
Keep going. I'm interested in that. Well, like the Stains, there's paradox here. There's contradictions. And I think one can look at it from the perspective of I'm unique and I'm going to enter society and that's going to get all stripped away from me and I'll be empty. From the other perspective, it's just cosmic horror, right? It's like, the idea that you're special in some way is a delusion, that you're going to be disabused of by life because, you know, your personality isn't all that important.
No.
And growing older is a lot of grappling with that. A lot of, oh man, I'm not quite as important as I thought I was.
Yeah. There is a humbling with age.
Doesn't leave you feeling great, but, you know, worthwhile to read these stories.
It's a cool story. I really like this. Surprisingly, one of my favorite Aikman stories. I don't know what about it that I just like so much.
It's got pornography and it's got vampires, so.
Exactly.
Those are top, you know, one and two on my checklist of entertainment.
What more do you want?
Yeah, so I was cool with it. Speaking of pornography and vampires, thank you once again, Greg Johnson, for. It makes no sense. For reading for us, you're always great.
Yeah, please check out Greg's Etsy store. He has so many cool props. So many posters, t-shirts, everything, anything your heart desires will be found there.
Yeah.
And it will bring you joy. You need these things in your life.
Your life is empty. Buy Greg's stuff. Fill it up. There are some folks that fill me with joy, and those are some patrons.
Oh, my God, yes.
For our show. I'd like to just say thanks to a few of them, if that's okay.
Yes, please.
I'm going to start by thanking William Radcliffe.
Hey, you know what? I'm going to join you. I want to thank Zachary Perry.
Michael Littlefield, thank you so much.
Amused to Death 47, thank you.
Robert Cooper, thank you so much.
Robert Poyton, thank you.
Jonathan Barry, thanks.
I'd like to thank Daniel Cloca.
Mike, thank you.
Sean, why do we only get Nerd Poker stuff on here? I want to shout out other great patrons like Escher Girls and Read It and Weep.
That is that person's patron handle. I think they're complaining that we don't really... A lot of people actually sign up to be patrons for the show, and yeah. I appreciate it deeply. But then their first comment is, I haven't heard my name yet. And it is Nerd Poker, where we sort of randomly thank folks. And so, sorry if your name hasn't come up yet. Please hang in there. But Sean is using his time. This is like Ving Rhames giving his award to Jack Lemmon. You know, Sean's using his time being thanked to thank other patrons, which is really cool. I also want to thank Bob Bradshaw.
I'd like to thank Gary G.
And finally, I'd like to thank Catherine Boussam. You guys are all fantastic. Thanks for hanging in with us during this inscrutable month of Aikman.
Yes.
We'll be back next time with The Trains. Until then, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Exclusively on Patreon.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.